They had understood, and they would play the game as he was playing it. The road foreman walked across the yards, looking down at the ground. He was thinking of his wife, his two children, and the house which he had spent a lifetime to own. He knew what his superiors were doing, and he wondered whether he should refuse to obey them. He had never been afraid of losing his job. With the confidence of a competent man, he had known that if he quarreled with one employer, he would always be able to find another. Now he was afraid. He had no right to quit or to seek a job. If he defied an employer, he would be delivered into the unanswerable power of a single board, and if the board ruled against him, it would mean being sentenced to the slow death of starvation. It would mean being barred from any employment. He knew that the board would rule against him. He knew that the key to the dark, capricious mystery of the board's contradictory decisions was the secret power of pull. What chance would he have against Mr. Chalmers? There had been a time when the self-interest of his employers had demanded that he exercise his utmost ability. Now ability was not wanted any longer. There had been a time when he had been required to do his best and rewarded accordingly. Now he could expect nothing but punishment if he tried to follow his conscience. There had been a time when he had been expected to think. Now, they did not want him to think, only to obey. They did not want him to have a conscience any longer. Then why should he raise his voice? For whose sake? He thought of the passengers, the 300 passengers aboard the Comet. He thought of his children. He had a son in high school, and a daughter, 19, of whom he was fiercely, painfully proud, because she was recognized as the most beautiful girl in town. He asked himself whether he could deliver his children to the fate of the children of the unemployed, as he had seen them in the blighted areas, in the settlements around closed factories, and along the tracks of discontinued railroads. He saw, in astonished horror, that the choice which he now had to make was between the lives of his children and the lives of the passengers on the Comet. A conflict of this kind had never been possible before. It was by protecting the safety of the passengers that he had earned the security of his children. He had served one by serving the other. There had been no clash of interests, no call for victims. Now, if he wanted to save the passengers, he had to do it at the price of his children. He remembered dimly the sermons he had heard about the beauty of self-immolation, about the virtue of sacrificing to others that which was one's dearest. He knew nothing about the philosophy of ethics, but he knew suddenly, not in words, but in the form of a dark, angry, savage pain, that if this was virtue, then he wanted no part of it. He walked into the roundhouse and ordered a large, ancient, coal-burning locomotive to be made ready for the run to Winston. The trainmaster reached for the telephone in the dispatcher's office to summon an engine crew as ordered, but his hand stopped, holding the receiver. It struck him suddenly that he was summoning men to their death, and that of the 20 lives listed on the sheet before him, 2 would be ended by his choice. He felt a physical sensation of cold. Nothing more. He felt no concern, only a puzzled, indifferent astonishment. It had never been his job to call men out to die. His job had been to call them out to earn their living. It was strange, he thought, and it was strange that his hand had stopped. What made it stop was like something he would have felt 20 years ago. No, he thought, strange. Only 1 month ago, not longer. He was 48 years old. He had no family, no friends, no ties to any living being in the world. Whatever capacity for devotion he had possessed, the capacity which others scatter among many random concerns, he had given it whole to the person of his young brother. The brother, his junior by 25 years, whom he had brought up. He had sent him through a technological college, and he had known, as had all the teachers, that the boy had the mark of genius on the forehead of his grim young face. With the same single-tracked devotion as his brother's, the boy had cared for nothing but his studies, not for sports or parties or girls, only for the vision of the things he was going to create as an inventor. He had graduated from college and had gone, on a salary unusual for his age, into the research laboratory of a great electrical concern in Massachusetts. This was now May 28th, thought the trainmaster. It was on May 1st that Directive 10-289 had been issued. It was on the evening of May 1st that he had been informed that his brother had committed suicide. The trainmaster had heard it said that the directive was necessary to save the country. He could not know whether this was true or not. He had no way of knowing what was necessary to save a country. But driven by some feeling which he could not express, he had walked into the office of the editor of the local newspaper and demanded that they publish the story of his brother's death. "People have to know it," had been all he could give as his reason. He had been unable to explain that the bruised connections of his mind had formed the wordless conclusion that if this was done by the will of the people, then the people had to know it. He could not believe that they would do it if they knew. The editor had refused. He had stated that it would be bad for the country's morale. The trainmaster knew nothing about political philosophy, but he knew that that had been the moment when he lost all concern for the life or death of any human being or of the country. He thought, holding the telephone receiver, that maybe he should warn the men whom he was about to call. They trusted him. It would never occur to them that he could knowingly send them to their death. But he shook his head. This was only an old thought, last year's thought, a remnant of the time when he had trusted them too. It did not matter now. His brain worked slowly, as if he were dragging his thoughts through a vacuum where no emotion responded to spur them on. He thought that there would be trouble if he warned anyone. There would be some sort of fight, and it was he who had to make some great effort to start it. He had forgotten what it was that one started this sort of fight for. Truth? Justice? Brother love? He did not want to make an effort. He was very tired. If he warned all the men on his list, he thought, there would be no one to run that engine. So he would save 2 lives and also 300 lives aboard the Comet. But nothing responded to the figures in his mind. Lives was just a word. It had no meaning. He raised the telephone receiver to his ear. He called 2 numbers. He summoned an engineer and a fireman to report for duty at once. Engine number 306 had left for Winston when Dave Mitchum came downstairs. "Get a track motor car ready for me," he ordered. "I'm going to run up to Fairmount." Fairmount was a small station 20 miles east on the line. The men nodded, asking no questions. Bill Brent was not among them. Mitchum walked into Brent's office. Brent was there, sitting silently at his desk. He seemed to be waiting. "I'm going to Fairmount," said Mitchum. His voice was aggressively too casual, as if implying that no answer was necessary. "They had a diesel there a couple of weeks ago. You know, emergency repairs or something. I'm going down to see if we could use it." He paused, but Brent said nothing. "The way things stack up," said Mitchum, not looking at him, "we can't hold that train till morning. We've got to take a chance one way or another. Now, I think maybe this diesel will do it, but that's the last one we can try for. So if you don't hear from me in 30 minutes, sign the order and send the Comet through with number 306 to Polar." Whatever Brent had thought, he could not believe it when he heard it. He did not answer at once. Then he said, very quietly, "No."
"What do you mean, no?"
"I won't do it."
"What do you mean you won't? It's an order."
"I won't do it." Brent's voice had the firmness of certainty unclouded by any emotion.
"Are you refusing to obey an order?"
"I am."
"But you have no right to refuse. And I'm not going to argue about it either. It's what I've decided. It's my responsibility, and I'm not asking for your opinion. Your job is to take my orders."
"Will you give me that order in writing?"
"Why, God damn you, are you hinting that you don't trust me? Are you—"
"Why do you have to go to Fairmount, Dave?" Why can't you telephone them about that diesel if you think that they have one?
You're not going to tell me how to do my job. You're not going to sit there and question me. You're going to keep your trap shut and do as you're told, or I'll give you a chance to talk to the Unification Board.
It was hard to decipher emotions on Brent's cowboy face, but Mitchum saw something that resembled a look of incredulous horror. Only it was horror at some sight of his own, not at the words, and it had no quality of fear, not the kind of fear Mitchum had hoped for. Brent knew that tomorrow morning the issue would be his word against Mitchum's. Mitchum would deny having given the order. Mitchum would show written proof that engine number 306 had been sent to Winston only to stand by, and would produce witnesses that he had gone to Fairmount in search of a diesel. Mitchum would claim that the fatal order had been issued by and on the sole responsibility of Bill Brent, the chief dispatcher. It would not be much of a case. Not a case that could bear close study, but it would be enough for the Unification Board, whose policy was consistent only in not permitting anything to be studied closely. Brent knew that he could play the same game and pass the frame-up on to another victim. He knew that he had the brains to work it out. Except that he would rather be dead than do it. It was not the sight of Mitchum that made him sit still in horror. It was the realization that there was no one whom he could call to expose this thing and stop it. No superior anywhere on the line, from Colorado to Omaha to New York. They were in on it, all of them. They were doing the same. They had given Mitchum the lead and the method. It was Dave Mitchum who now belonged on this railroad, and he, Bill Brent, who did not. As Bill Brent had learned to see, by a single glance at a few numbers on a sheet of paper, the entire trackage of a division, so he was now able to see the whole of his own life and the full price of the decision he was making. He had not fallen in love until he was past his youth. He had been 36 when he had found the woman he wanted. He had been engaged to her for the last 4 years. He had had to wait, because he had a mother to support and a widowed sister with 3 children. He had never been afraid of burdens, because he had known his ability to carry them, and he had never assumed an obligation unless he was certain that he could fulfill it. He had waited. He had saved his money, and now he had reached the time when he felt himself free to be happy. He was to be married in a few weeks, this coming June. He thought of it, as he sat at his desk, looking at Dave Mitchum, but the thought aroused no hesitation, only regret and a distant sadness. Distant, because he knew that he could not let it be part of this moment. Bill Brent knew nothing about epistemology, but he knew that man must live by his own rational perception of reality, that he cannot act against it or escape it or find a substitute for it, and that there is no other way for him to live. He rose to his feet. "It's true that so long as I hold this job, I cannot refuse to obey you," he said. "But I can, if I quit. So I'm quitting."
"You're what?"
"I'm quitting, as of this moment."
"But you have no right to quit, you goddamn bastard. Don't you know that? Don't you know that I'll have you thrown in jail for it?"
"If you want to send the sheriff for me in the morning, I'll be at home. I won't try to escape. There's no place to go." Dave Mitchum was 6'2" and had the build of a bruiser, but he stood shaking with fury and terror over the delicate figure of Bill Brent.
"You can't quit. There's a law against it. I've got a law. You can't walk out on me. I won't let you out. I won't let you leave this building tonight."
Brent walked to the door. "Will you repeat that order you gave me in front of the others?" "No? Then I will." As he pulled the door open, Mitchum's fist shot out, smashed into his face, and knocked him down. The trainmaster and the road foreman stood in the open doorway.
"He quit," screamed Mitchum. "The yellow bastard quit at a time like this. He's a lawbreaker and a coward."
In the slow effort of rising from the floor, through the haze of blood running into his eyes, Bill Brent looked up at the two men. He saw that they understood, but he saw the closed faces of men who did not want to understand, did not want to interfere, and hated him for putting them on the spot in the name of justice. He said nothing, rose to his feet, and walked out of the building. Mitchum avoided looking at the others. "Hey, you," he called, jerking his head at the night dispatcher across the room. "Come here. You've got to take over at once." With the door closed, he repeated to the boy the story of the diesel at Fairmount, as he had given it to Brent, and the order to send the Comet through with engine number 306 if the boy did not hear from him in half an hour. The boy was in no condition to think, to speak, or to understand anything. He kept seeing the blood on the face of Bill Brent, who had been his idol.
"Yes, sir,"
he answered numbly. Dave Mitchum departed for Fairmount, announcing to every yard man, switchman, and wiper in sight as he boarded the track motor car that he was going in search of a diesel for the Comet. The night dispatcher sat at his desk, watching the clock and the telephone, praying that the telephone would ring and let him hear from Mr. Mitchum. But the half-hour went by in silence, and when there were only 3 minutes left, the boy felt a terror he could not explain, except that he did not want to send that order. He turned to the trainmaster and the road foreman, asking hesitantly,
"Mr. Mitchum gave me an order before he left, but I wonder whether I ought to send it, because I don't think it's right. He said..."
The trainmaster turned away. He felt no pity. The boy was about the same age as his brother had been. The road foreman snapped, "Do just as Mr. Mitchum told you. You're not supposed to think," and walked out of the room. The responsibility that James Taggart and Clifton Losey had evaded now rested on the shoulders of a trembling, bewildered boy. He hesitated. Then he buttressed his courage with the thought that one did not doubt the good faith and the competence of railroad executives. He did not know that his vision of a railroad and its executives was that of a century ago. With the conscientious precision of a railroad man, in the moment when the hand of the clock ended the half-hour, he signed his name to the order instructing the Comet to proceed with engine number 306 and transmitted the order to Winston Station. The station agent at Winston shuddered when he looked at the order, but he was not the man to defy authority. He told himself that the tunnel was not perhaps as dangerous as he thought. He told himself that the best policy these days was not to think. When he handed their copies of the order to the conductor and the engineer of the Comet, the conductor glanced slowly about the room, from face to face, folded the slip of paper, put it into his pocket, and walked out without a word. The engineer stood looking at the paper for a moment, then threw it down and said, "I'm not going to do it. And if it's come to where this railroad hands out orders like this one, I'm not going to work for it either. Just list me as having quit."
"But you can't quit," cried the station agent. "They'll arrest you for it."
"If they find me," said the engineer, and walked out of the station into the vast darkness of the mountain night. The engineer from Silver Springs, who had brought in number 306, was sitting in a corner of the room. He chuckled and said, "He's yellow." The station agent turned to him.
"Will you do it, Joe? Will you take the Comet?"
Joe Scott was drunk. There had been a time when a railroad man, reporting for duty with any sign of intoxication, would have been regarded as a doctor arriving for work with sores of smallpox on his face. But Joe Scott was a privileged person. 3 months ago, he had been fired for an infraction of safety rules, which had caused a major wreck. 2 weeks ago, he had been reinstated in his job by order of the Unification Board. He was a friend of Fred Kinnon. He protected Kinnon's interests in his union, not against the employers, but against the membership.
"Sure," said Joe Scott. "I'll take the Comet. I'll get her through, if I go fast enough."
The fireman of number 306 had remained in the cab of his engine. He looked up uneasily when they came to switch his engine to the head of the Comet. He looked up at the red and green lights of the tunnel, hanging in the distance above 20 miles of curves. But he was a placid, amicable fellow, who made a good fireman with no hope of ever rising to engineer. His husky muscles were his only asset. He felt certain that his superiors knew what they were doing, so he did not venture any questions. The conductor stood by the rear end of the comet. He looked at the lights of the tunnel, then at the long chain of the comet's windows. A few windows were lighted, but most of them showed only the feeble blue glow of night lamps edging the lowered blinds. He thought that he should rouse the passengers and warn them. There had been a time when he had placed the safety of the passengers above his own, not by reason of love for his fellow men, but because that responsibility was part of his job, which he accepted and felt pride in fulfilling. Now, he felt a contemptuous indifference and no desire to save them. They had asked for and accepted Directive 10-289, he thought, then went on living and daily turning away in evasion from the kind of verdicts that the Unification Board was passing on defenseless victims. Why shouldn't he now turn away from them? If he saved their lives, not one of them would come forward to defend him when the Unification Board would convict him for disobeying orders, for creating a panic, for delaying Mr. Chalmers. He had no desire to be a martyr for the sake of allowing people safely to indulge in their own irresponsible evil. When the moment came, he raised his lantern and signaled the engineer to start. "See?" said Kip Chalmers triumphantly to Lester Tuck, as the wheels under their feet shuddered forward. "Fear is the only practical means to deal with people." The conductor stepped onto the vestibule of the last car. No one saw him as he went down the steps of the other side, slipped off the train, and vanished into the darkness of the mountains. A switchman stood ready to throw the switch that would send the comet from the siding onto the main track. He looked at the comet as it came slowly toward him. It was only a blazing white globe with a beam stretching high above his head and a jerky thunder trembling through the rail under his feet. He knew that the switch should not be thrown. He thought of the night 10 years ago, when he had risked his life in a flood to save a train from a washout. But he knew that times had changed. In the moment when he threw the switch and saw the headlight jerk sideways, he knew that he would now hate his job for the rest of his life. The comet uncoiled from the siding into a thin straight line and went on into the mountains, with the beam of the headlight like an extended arm pointing the way, and the lighted glass curve of the observation lounge ending it off. Some of the passengers aboard the comet were awake. As the train started its coiling ascent, they saw the small cluster of Winston's lights at the bottom of the darkness beyond their windows, then the same darkness, but with red and green lights by the hole of a tunnel on the upper edge of the window panes. The lights of Winston kept growing smaller each time they appeared. The black hole of the tunnel kept growing larger. A black veil went streaking past the windows at times, dimming the lights. It was the heavy smoke from the coal-burning engine. As the tunnel came closer, they saw, on the edge of the sky far to the south, in a void of space and rock, a spot of living fire twisting in the wind. They did not know what it was, and did not care to learn. It is said that catastrophes are a matter of pure chance, and there were those who would have said that the passengers of the comet were not guilty or responsible for the thing that happened to them. The man in bedroom A, car number 1, was a professor of sociology who taught that individual ability is of no consequence, that individual effort is futile, that an individual conscience is a useless luxury, that there is no individual mind or character or achievement, that everything is achieved collectively, and that it's masses that count, not men. The man in roomette 7, car number 2, was a journalist who wrote that it is proper and moral to use compulsion for a good cause, who believed that he had the right to unleash physical force upon others, to wreck lives, throttle ambitions, strangle desires, violate convictions, to imprison, to despoil, to murder, for the sake of whatever he chose to consider as his own idea of a good cause, which did not even have to be an idea, since he had never defined what he regarded as the good, but had merely stated that he went by a feeling unrestrained by any knowledge, since he considered emotion superior to knowledge and relied solely on his own good intentions and on the power of a gun. The woman in room at 10, car number 3, was an elderly schoolteacher who had spent her life turning class after class of helpless children into miserable cowards by teaching them that the will of the majority is the only standard of good and evil, that a majority may do anything it pleases, that they must not assert their own personalities, but must do as others were doing. The man in drawing room B, car number 4, was a newspaper publisher who believed that men are evil by nature and unfit for freedom, that their basic instincts, if left unchecked, are to lie, to rob, and to murder one another, and therefore men must be ruled by means of lies, robbery, and murder, which must be made the exclusive privilege of the rulers, for the purpose of forcing men to work, teaching them to be moral, and keeping them within the bounds of order and justice. The man in bedroom H, car number 5, was a businessman who had acquired his business, an ore mine, with the help of a government loan, under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. The man in drawing room A, car number 6, was a financier who had made a fortune by buying frozen railroad bonds and getting his friends in Washington to defreeze them. The man in seat 5, car number 7, was a worker who believed that he had a right to a job, whether his employer wanted him or not. The woman in roomette 6, car number 8, was a lecturer who believed that, as a consumer, she had a right to transportation, whether the railroad people wished to provide it or not. The man in roomette 2, car number 9, was a professor of economics who advocated the abolition of private property, explaining that intelligence plays no part in industrial production, that man's mind is conditioned by material tools, that anybody can run a factory or a railroad, and it's only a matter of seizing the machinery. The woman in bedroom D, car number 10, was a mother who had put her 2 children to sleep in the berth above her, carefully tucking them in, protecting them from drafts and jolts. A mother whose husband held a government job enforcing directives, which she defended by saying, "I don't care. It's only the rich that they hurt. After all, I must think of my children." The man in roomette 3, car number 11, was a sniveling little neurotic who wrote cheap little plays into which, as a social message, he inserted cowardly little obscenities to the effect that all businessmen were scoundrels. The woman in room at 9, car number 12, was a housewife who believed that she had the right to elect politicians, of whom she knew nothing, to control giant industries, of which she had no knowledge. The man in bedroom F, car number 13, was a lawyer who had said, "Me? I'll find a way to get along under any political system." The man in bedroom A, car number 14, was a professor of philosophy who taught that there is no mind. How do you know that the tunnel is dangerous? No reality. How can you prove that the tunnel exists? No logic. Why do you claim that trains cannot move without motive power? No principles. Why should you be bound by the law of cause and effect? No rights. Why shouldn't you attach men to their jobs by force? No morality. What's moral about running a railroad? No absolutes. What difference does it make to you whether you live or die anyway? He taught that we know nothing. Why oppose the orders of your superiors? That we can never be certain of anything. How do you know you're right? That we must act on the expediency of the moment. You don't want to risk your job, do you? The man in drawing room B, car number 15, was an heir who had inherited his fortune and who had kept repeating, "Why should Reardon be the only one permitted to manufacture Reardon metal?" The man in bedroom A, car number 16, was a humanitarian who had said, "The men of ability?
I do not care what or if they are made to suffer. They must be penalized in order to support the incompetent. Frankly, I do not care whether this is just or not. I take pride in not caring to grant any justice to the able, where mercy to the needy is concerned. These passengers were awake. There was not a man aboard the train who did not share one or more of their ideas. As the train went into the tunnel, the flame of Wyatt's torch was the last thing they saw on Earth.
Chapter 8. By Our Love. The sun touched the treetops on the slope of the hill, and they looked a bluish silver, catching the color of the sky. Dagny stood at the door of the cabin, with the first sun rays on her forehead, and miles of forest spread under her feet. The leaves went down from silver to green to the smoky blue of the shadows on the road below. The light trickled down through the branches and shot upward in sudden spurts when it hit a clump of ferns that became a fountain of green rays. It gave her pleasure to watch the motion of the light over a stillness where nothing else could move. She had marked the date, as she did each morning on the sheet of paper she had tacked to the wall of her room. The progression of the dates on that paper was the only movement in the stillness of her days, like the record kept by a prisoner on a desert island. This morning's date was May 28th. She had intended the dates to lead to a purpose, but she could not say whether she had reached it or not. She had come here with three assignments given as orders to herself. Rest. Learn to live without the railroad. Get the pain out of the way. Get it out of the way, were the words she used. She felt as if she were tied to some wounded stranger who could be stricken at any moment by an attack that would drown her in his screams. She felt no pity for the stranger, only a contemptuous impatience. She had to fight him and destroy him. Then her way would be clear to decide what she wished to do. But the stranger was not easy to fight. The assignment to rest had been easier. She found that she liked the solitude. She awakened in the morning with a feeling of confident benevolence, a sense that she could venture forth and be willing to deal with whatever she found. In the city, she had lived in chronic tension to withstand the shock of anger, indignation, disgust, contempt. The only danger to threaten her here was the simple pain of some physical accident. It seemed innocent and easy by comparison. The cabin was far from any traveled road. It had remained as her father had left it. She cooked her meals on a wood-burning stove and gathered the wood on the hillsides. She cleared the brush from under her walls. She reshingled the roof. She repainted the door and the frames of the windows. Rains, weeds, and brush had swallowed the steps of what had once been a terraced path rising up the hill from the road to the cabin. She rebuilt it, clearing the terraces, relaying the stones, bracing the banks of soft earth with walls of boulders. It gave her pleasure to devise complex systems of levers and pulleys out of old scraps of iron and rope, then to move weights of rock that were much beyond her physical power. She planted a few seeds of nasturtiums and morning glories to see one spreading slowly over the ground and the other climbing up the tree trunks, to see them grow, to see progression and movement. The work gave her the calm she needed. She had not noticed how she began it or why. She had started without conscious intention, but she saw it growing under her hands, pulling her forward, giving her a healing sense of peace. Then she understood that what she needed was the motion to a purpose, no matter how small or in what form, the sense of an activity going step by step to some chosen end across a span of time. The work of cooking a meal was like a closed circle, completed and gone, leading nowhere. But the work of building a path was a living sum, so that no day was left to die behind her, but each day contained all those that preceded it. Each day acquired its immortality on every succeeding tomorrow. A circle, she thought, is the movement proper to physical nature. They say that there's nothing but circular motion in the inanimate universe around us, but the straight line is the badge of man. The straight line of a geometrical abstraction that makes roads, rails and bridges, the straight line that cuts the curving aimlessness of nature by a purposeful motion from a start to an end. The cooking of meals, she thought, is like the feeding of coal to an engine for the sake of a great run. But what would be the imbecile torture of coaling an engine that had no run to make? It is not proper for man's life to be a circle, she thought, or a string of circles dropping off like zeros behind him. Man's life must be a straight line of motion from goal to farther goal, each leading to the next and to a single growing sum, like a journey down the track of a railroad, from station to station to... Oh, stop it. Stop it, she told herself in quiet severity when the scream of the wounded stranger was choked off. Don't think of that. Don't look too far. You like building this path. Build it. Don't look beyond the foot of the hill. She had driven a few times to the store in Woodstock, 20 miles away, to buy supplies and food. Woodstock was a small huddle of dying structures, built generations ago for some reason and hope long since forgotten. There was no railroad to feed it, no electric power, nothing but a county highway growing emptier year by year. The only store was a wooden hovel with spider-eaten corners and a rotted patch in the middle of the floor, eaten by the rains that came through the leaking roof. The storekeeper was a fat, pallid woman who moved with effort, but seemed indifferent to her own discomfort. The stock of food consisted of dusty cans with faded labels, some grain, and a few vegetables rotting in ancient bins outside the door. "Why don't you move those vegetables out of the sun?" Dagny asked once. The woman looked at her blankly, as if unable to understand the possibility of such a question. "They've always been there," she answered indifferently. Driving back to the cabin, Dagny looked up at a mountain stream that fell with ferocious force down a sheer granite wall, its spray hanging like a mist of rainbows in the sun. She thought that one could build a hydroelectric plant, just large enough to supply the power for her cabin and for the town of Woodstock. Woodstock could be made to be productive. Those wild apple trees she saw in such unusual numbers among the dense growth on the hillsides were the remnants of orchards. Suppose one were to reclaim them, then build a small spur to the nearest railroad. Oh, stop it. No kerosene today, the storekeeper told her on her next trip to Woodstock. It rained Thursday night, and when it rains, the trucks can't get through Fairfield Gorge. The road's flooded, and the kerosene truck won't be back this way till next month. If you know that the road gets flooded every time it rains, why don't you people repair it? The woman answered, "The road's always been that way." Driving back, Dagny stopped on the crest of a hill and looked down at the miles of countryside below. She looked at Fairfield Gorge, where the county road, twisting through marshy soil below the level of a river, got trapped in a crack between two hills. It would be simple to bypass those hills, she thought, to build a road on the other side of the river. The people of Woodstock had nothing to do. She could teach them. Cut a road straight to the southwest, save miles, connect with the state highway at the freight depot of... Oh, stop it! She put her kerosene lamp aside and sat in her cabin after dark by the light of a candle, listening to the music of a small portable radio. She hunted for symphony concerts and twisted the dial rapidly past whenever she caught the raucous syllables of a news broadcast. She did not want any news from the city. Don't think of Taggart Transcontinental, she had told herself on her first night in the cabin. Don't think of it until you're able to hear the words as if they were Atlantic Southern or Associated Steel. But the weeks passed, and no scar would grow over the wound. It seemed to her as if she were fighting the unpredictable cruelty of her own mind. She would lie in bed, drifting off to sleep, then find herself suddenly thinking that the conveyor belt was worn at the coaling station at Willow Bend, Indiana. She had seen it from the window of her car on her last trip. She must tell them to replace it, or they... And then she would be sitting up in bed, crying, "Stop it!" and stopping it, but remaining awake for the rest of that night. She would sit at the door of the cabin at sunset and watch the motion of the leaves growing still in the twilight. Then she would see the sparks of the fireflies rising from the grass, flashing on and off in every darkening corner, flashing slowly, as if holding one moment's warning. They were like the lights of signals winking at night over the track of a... Stop it! It was the times when she could not stop it that she dreaded. The times when, unable to stand up, as in physical pain, with no limit to divide it from the pain on her mind, she would fall down on the floor of the cabin or on the earth of the woods and sit still with her face pressed to a chair or a rock and fight not to let herself scream aloud while they were suddenly as close to her and as real as the body of a lover, the two lines of rail going off to a single point in the distance, the front of an engine cutting space apart by means of the letters TT, the sound of the wheels clicking in accented rhythm under the floor of her car, the statue of Nat Taggart in the concourse of the terminal. Fighting not to know them, not to feel them, her body rigid but for the grinding motion of her face against her arm, she would draw whatever power over her consciousness still remained to her into the soundless, toneless repetition of the words, "Get it over with." There were long stretches of calm, when she was able to face her problem with the dispassionate clarity of weighing a problem in engineering. But she could find no answer. She knew that her desperate longing for the railroad would vanish, were she to convince herself that it was impossible or improper. But the longing came from the certainty that the truth and the right were hers, that the enemy was the irrational and the unreal, that she could not set herself another goal or summon the love to achieve it while her rightful achievement had been lost, not to some superior power, but to a loathsome evil that conquered by means of impotence. She could renounce the railroad, she thought. She could find contentment here, in this forest. But she would build the path, then reach the road below, then rebuild the road. And then she would reach the storekeeper of Woodstock, and that would be the end, and the empty white face staring at the universe in stagnant apathy would be the limit placed on her effort. Why? She heard herself screaming aloud. There was no answer. Then stay here until you answer it, she thought. You have no place to go. You can't move. You can't start grading a right of way until you know enough to choose a terminal. There were long silent evenings when the emotion that made her sit still and look at the unattainable distance beyond the fading light to the south was loneliness for Hank Reardon. She wanted the sight of his unyielding face, the confident face looking at her with the hint of a smile. But she knew that she could not see him until her battle was won. His smile had to be deserved. It was intended for an adversary who traded her strength against his, not for a pain-beaten wretch who would seek relief in that smile and thus destroy its meaning. He could help her to live. He could not help her to decide for what purpose she wished to go on living. She had felt a faint touch of anxiety since the morning when she marked May 15th on her calendar. She had forced herself to listen to news broadcasts once in a while. She had heard no mention of his name. Her fear for him was her last link to the city. It kept drawing her eyes to the horizon at the south and down to the road at the foot of the hill. She found herself waiting for him to come. She found herself listening for the sound of a motor. But the only sound to give her a futile start of hope at times was the sudden crackle of some large bird's wings hurtling through the branches into the sky. There was another link to the past that still remained as an unsolved question. Quentin Daniels and the motor that he was trying to rebuild. By June 1st, she would owe him his monthly check. Should she tell him that she had quit, that she would never need that motor and neither would the world? Should she tell him to stop and to let the remnant of the motor vanish in rust on some junk pile as the one where she had found it? She could not force herself to do it. It seemed harder than leaving the railroad. That motor, she thought, was not a link to the past. It was her last link to the future. To kill it seemed like an act not of murder, but of suicide. Her order to stop it would be her signature under the certainty that there was no terminal for her to seek ahead. But it is not true, she thought, as she stood at the door of her cabin on this morning of May 28th. It is not true that there is no place in the future for a superlative achievement of man's mind. It can never be true. No matter what her problem, this would always remain to her, this immovable conviction that evil was unnatural and temporary. She felt it more clearly than ever this morning, the certainty that the ugliness of the men in the city and the ugliness of her suffering were transient accidents, while the smiling sense of hope within her at the sight of a sun-flooded forest, the sense of an unlimited promise, was the permanent and the real. She stood at the door, smoking a cigarette. In the room behind her, the sounds of a symphony of her grandfather's time were coming from the radio. She barely listened. She was conscious only of the flow of chords that seemed to play an underscoring harmony for the flow of the smoke curving slowly from her cigarette, for the curving motion of her arm moving the cigarette to her lips once in a while. She closed her eyes and stood still, feeling the rays of the sun on her body. This was the achievement, she thought. To enjoy this moment, to let no memory of pain blunt her capacity to feel as she felt right now. So long as she could preserve this feeling, she would have the fuel to go on. She was barely aware of a faint noise that came through the music, like the scratching of an old record. The first thing to reach her consciousness was the sudden jerk of her own hand flinging the cigarette aside. It came in the same instant as the realization that the noise was growing louder and that it was the sound of a motor. Then she knew that she had not admitted to herself how much she had wanted to hear that sound, how desperately she had waited for Hank Reardon. She heard her own chuckle. It was humbly, cautiously low, as if not to disturb the drone of revolving metal which was now the unmistakable sound of a car rising up the mountain road. She could not see the road. The small stretch under the arch of branches at the foot of the hill was her only view of it, but she watched the car's ascent by the growing, imperious strain of the motor against the grades and the screech of the tires on curves. The car stopped under the arch of branches. She did not recognize it. It was not the black Hammond, but a long gray convertible. She saw the driver step out. It was a man whose presence here could not be possible. It was Francisco D'Anconia. The shock she felt was not disappointment. It was more like the sensation that disappointment would now be irrelevant. It was eagerness and an odd, solemn stillness, the sudden certainty that she was facing the approach of something unknown and of the gravest importance. The swiftness of Francisco's movements was carrying him toward the hill while he was raising his head to glance up. He saw her above, at the door of the cabin, and stopped. She could not distinguish the expression on his face. He stood still for a long moment, his face raised to her. Then he started up the hill. She felt, almost as if she had expected it, that this was a scene from their childhood. He was coming toward her, not running, but moving upward with a kind of triumphant, confident eagerness. No, she thought, this was not their childhood. It was the future as she would have seen it then, in the days when she waited for him as for her release from prison. It was a moment's view of a morning they would have reached if her vision of life had been fulfilled, if they had both gone the way she had then been so certain of going. Held motionless by wonder, she stood looking at him, taking this moment not in the name of the present, but as a salute to their past. When he was close enough and she could distinguish his face, she saw the look of that luminous gaiety which transcends the solemn by proclaiming the great innocence of a man who has earned the right to be light-hearted. He was smiling and whistling some piece of music that seemed to flow like the long, smooth, rising flight of his steps. The melody seemed distantly familiar to her. She felt that it belonged with this moment, yet she felt also that there was something odd about it, something important to grasp, only she could not think of it now.
Hi, Slug.
Hi, Frisco.
She knew, by the way he looked at her, by an instant's drop of his eyelids closing his eyes, by the brief pull of his head striving to lean back and resist, by the faint, half-smiling, half-helpless relaxation of his lips, then by the sudden harshness of his arms as he seized her, that it was involuntary, that he had not intended it, and that it was irresistibly right for both of them. The desperate violence of the way he held her, the hurting pressure of his mouth on hers, the exultant surrender of his body to the touch of hers, were not the form of a moment's pleasure. She knew that no physical hunger could bring a man to this. She knew that it was the statement she had never heard from him, the greatest confession of love a man could make. No matter what he had done to wreck his life, this was still the Francisco d'Anconia in whose bed she had been so proud of belonging. No matter what betrayals she had met from the world, her vision of life had been true, and some indestructible part of it had remained within him. And in answer to it, her body responded to his. Her arms and mouth held him, confessing her desire, confessing an acknowledgement she had always given him and always would. Then the rest of his years came back to her, with a stab of the pain of knowing that the greater his person, the more terrible his guilt in destroying it. She pulled herself away from him. She shook her head. She said, in answer to both of them, "No." He stood looking at her, disarmed and smiling. "Not yet. You have a great deal to forgive me first, but I can tell you everything now." She had never heard that low, breathless quality of helplessness in his voice. He was fighting to regain control. There was almost a touch of apology in his smile, the apology of a child pleading for indulgence. But there was also an adult's amusement, the laughing declaration that he did not have to hide his struggle, since it was happiness that he was wrestling with, not pain. She backed away from him. She felt as if emotion had flung her ahead of her own consciousness, and questions were now catching up with her, groping toward the form of words. "Dagny, that torture you've been going through here for the last month, answer me as honestly as you can. Do you think you could have borne it 12 years ago?" "No," she answered. He smiled. "Why do you ask that?" "To redeem 12 years of my life, which I won't have to regret."
"What do you mean?"
And
her questions had caught up with her. "And what do you know about my torture here?"
"Dagny, aren't you beginning to see that I would know everything about it?"
"How did you... Francisco, what were you whistling when you were coming up the hill?"
"Why, was I? I don't know.
It was the 5th concerto by Richard Halley, wasn't it?"
"Oh."
He looked startled, then smiled in amusement at himself, then answered gravely,
"I'll tell you that later."
"How did you find out where I was?"
"I'll tell you that, too."
"You forced it out of Eddie."
"I haven't seen Eddie for over a year."
"He was the only one who knew it."
"It wasn't Eddie who told me."
"I didn't want anybody to find me."
He glanced slowly about him. She saw his eyes stop on the path she had built, on the planted flowers, on the fresh shingled roof. He chuckled, as if he understood and as if it hurt him.
"You shouldn't have been left here for a month," he said.
"God, you shouldn't have.
It's my first failure, at the one time when I didn't want to fail. But I didn't think you were ready to quit. Had I known it, I would have watched you day and night."
"Really? What for?"
"To spare you." He pointed at her work. "All this."
"Francisco," she said, her voice low, "if you're concerned about my torture, don't you know that I don't want to hear you speak of it? Because..."
She stopped. She had never complained to him, not in all those years. Her voice flat, she said only,
"that I don't want to hear it. Because I'm the one man who has no right to speak of it. Dagny,
If you think that I don't know how much I've hurt you, I'll tell you about the years when I... But it's over. Oh, darling, it's over.
Is it?
Forgive me. I mustn't say that. Not until you say it. He was trying to control his voice, but the look of happiness was beyond his power of control. Are you happy? Because I've lost everything I lived for. All right, I'll say it. If this is what you've come to hear. You were the first thing I lost. Does it amuse you now to see that I've lost the rest?
He glanced straight at her, his eyes drawn narrow by such an intensity of earnestness that the glance was almost a threat, and she knew that whatever the years had meant to him, amusement was the one word she had no right to utter.
"Do you really think that?"
he asked.
She whispered, "No."
"Dagny, we can never lose the things we live for. We may have to change their form at times, if we've made an error, but the purpose remains the same, and the forms are ours to make."
"That is what I've been telling myself for a month, but there's no way left open toward any purpose whatever."
He did not answer. He sat down on a boulder by the door of the cabin, watching her as if he did not want to miss a single shadow of reaction on her face.
"Do you think now of the men who quit and vanished?"
he asked. She shrugged, with a faint smile of helpless sadness, and sat down on the ground beside him.
"You know," she said, "I used to think that there was some destroyer who came after them and made them quit. But I guess there wasn't. There have been times this past month when I've almost wished he would come for me too. But nobody came."
"No?"
"No. I used to think that he gave them some inconceivable reason to make them betray everything they loved. But that wasn't necessary. I know how they felt. I can't blame them any longer. What I don't know is how they learned to exist afterward, if any of them still exist."
"Do you feel that you've betrayed Taggart Transcontinental?"
"I feel that I would have betrayed it by remaining at work."
"You would have."
"If I had agreed to serve the looters, it's Nat Taggart that I would have delivered to them. I couldn't. I couldn't let his achievement and mine end up with the looters as our final goal."
"No,
you couldn't.
Do you call this indifference? Do you think that you love the railroad less than you did a month ago?"
"I think that I would give my life for just one more year on the railroad. But I can't go back to it."
"Then you know what they felt, all the men who quit, and what it was that they loved when they gave up."
"Francisco,"
she asked, not looking at him, her head bent,
"why did you ask me whether I could have given it up 12 years ago?"
"Don't you know what night I am thinking of? Just as you are."
"Yes," she whispered.
"That was the night I gave up Danconia Copper." Slowly, with a long effort, she moved her head to glance up at him. His face had the expression she had seen then on that next morning 12 years ago. The look of a smile, though he was not smiling. The quiet look of victory over pain. The look of a man's pride in the price he paid, and in that which made it worth paying.
"But you didn't give it up," she said. "You didn't quit. You're still the president of Danconia Copper, only it means nothing to you now."
"It means as much to me now as it did that night."
"Then how can you let it go to pieces?"
"Dagny, you're more fortunate than I. Taggart Transcontinental is a delicate piece of precision machinery. It will not last long without you. It cannot be run by slave labor. They will mercifully destroy it for you, and you won't have to see it serving the looters. But copper mining is a simpler job. Danconia Copper could have lasted for generations of looters and slaves. crudely, miserably, ineptly, but it could have lasted and helped them to last. I had to destroy it myself.
You... what?
I am destroying Danconia Copper, consciously, deliberately, by plan and by my own hand. I have to plan it as carefully and work as hard as if I were producing a fortune, in order not to let them notice it and stop me, in order not to let them seize the mines until it is too late. All the effort and energy I had hoped to spend on Danconia Copper, I'm spending them, only it's not to make it grow. I shall destroy every last bit of it, and every last penny of my fortune, and every ounce of copper that could feed the looters. I shall not leave it as I found it. I shall leave it as Sebastian Danconia found it. Then let them try to exist without him or me.
Francisco, she screamed. How could you make yourself do it?
By the grace of the same love as yours, he answered quietly. My love for Danconia Copper, for the spirit of which it was the shape, was, and some day, will be again. She sat still, trying to grasp all the implications of what she now grasped only as the numbness of shock. In the silence, the music of the radio symphony went on, and the rhythm of the chords reached her like the slow, solemn pounding of steps, while she struggled to see at once the whole progression of 12 years. The tortured boy who called for help on her breasts, the man who sat on the floor of a drawing room, playing marbles and laughing at the destruction of great industries, the man who cried, "My love, I can't," while refusing to help her, the man who drank a toast in the dim booth of a barroom to the years which Sebastian Danconia had had to wait.
Francisco, of all the guesses I tried to make about you, I never thought of it. I never thought that you were one of those men who had quit.
I was one of the first of them.
I thought that they always vanished.
Well, hadn't I? Wasn't it the worst of what I did to you? That I left you looking at a cheap playboy who was not the Francisco Danconia you had known?
Yes, she whispered. Only the worst was that I couldn't believe it. I never did. It was Francisco Danconia that I kept seeing every time I saw you.
I know. And I know what it did to you. I tried to help you understand, but it was too soon to tell you. Dagny, if I had told you, that night or the day when you came to damn me for the San Sebastian mines, that I was not an aimless loafer, that I was out to speed up the destruction of everything we had held sacred together, the destruction of Danconia Copper, of Taggart Transcontinental, of Wyatt Oil, of Reardon Steel, would you have found it easier to take?
Harder, she whispered. I'm not sure I can take it even now. Neither your kind of renunciation nor my own. But Francisco,
she threw her head back suddenly to look up at him.
If this was your secret, then of all the hell you had to take, I was...
Oh, yes, my darling, yes. You were the worst of it. It was a desperate cry, its sound of laughter and of release confessing all the agony he wanted to sweep away. He seized her hand, he pressed his mouth to it, then his face, not to let her see the reflection of what his years had been like.
If it's any kind of atonement, which it isn't,
whatever I made you suffer, that's how I paid for it, by knowing what I was doing to you and having to do it,
and waiting.
Waiting to...
But it's over.
He raised his head, smiling. He looked down at her, and she saw a look of protective tenderness come into his face, which told her of the despair he saw in hers.
Dagny, don't think of that. I won't claim any suffering of mine as my excuse. Whatever my reason, I knew what I was doing, and I've hurt you terribly. I'll need years to make up for it.
forget what. She knew that he meant what his embrace had confessed, what I haven't said. Of all the things I have to tell you, that is the one I'll say last. But his eyes, his smile, the grasp of his fingers on her wrist were saying it against his will. You've borne too much, and there's a great deal that you have to learn to understand in order to lose every scar of the torture you never should have had to bear. All that matters now is that you're free to recover. We're free, both of us. We're free of the looters. We're out of their reach. She said, her voice quietly desolate, That's what I came here for, to try to understand. But I can't. It seems monstrously wrong to surrender the world to the looters, and monstrously wrong to live under their rule. I can neither give up nor go back. I can neither exist without work nor work as a serf. I had always thought that any sort of battle was proper, anything except renunciation. I'm not sure we're right to quit, you and I, when we should have fought them. But there is no way to fight. It's surrender if we leave, and surrender if we remain. I don't know what is right any longer. Check your premises, Dagny. Contradictions don't exist. But I can't find any answer. I can't condemn you for what you're doing, yet it's horror that I feel. Admiration and horror at the same time. You, the heir of the Danconias, who could have surpassed all his ancestors of the miraculous hand that produced, you're turning your matchless ability to the job of destruction. And I'm playing with cobblestones and shingling a roof while a transcontinental railroad system is collapsing in the hands of congenital ward healers. Yet you and I were the kind who determined the fate of the world. If this is what we let it come to, then it must have been our own guilt. But I can't see the nature of our error.
Yes, Dagny, it was our own guilt.
Because we didn't work hard enough?
Because we worked too hard, and charged too little.
What do you mean?
We never demanded the one payment that the world owed us, and we let our best reward go to the worst of men. The error was made centuries ago. It was made by Sebastian Danconia, by Nat Taggart, by every man who fed the world and received no thanks in return. You don't know what is right any longer? Dagny, this is not a battle over material goods. It's a moral crisis, the greatest the world has ever faced, and the last. Our age is the climax of centuries of evil. We must put an end to it once and for all, or perish. We, the men of the mind. It was our own guilt. We produced the wealth of the world, but we let our enemies write its moral code. But we never accepted their code. We lived by our own standards. Yes, and paid ransoms for it. Ransoms in matter and in spirit. In money, which our enemies received but did not deserve, and in honor, which we deserved but did not receive. That was our guilt. That we were willing to pay. We kept mankind alive, yet we allowed men to despise us and to worship our destroyers. We allowed them to worship incompetence and brutality, the recipients and the dispensers of the unearned. By accepting punishment, not for any sins, but for our virtues, we betrayed our code and made theirs possible. Dagny. Theirs is the morality of kidnappers. They use your love of virtue as a hostage. They know that you'll bear anything in order to work and produce, because you know that achievement is man's highest moral purpose, that he can't exist without it, and your love of virtue is your love of life. They count on you to assume any burden. They count on you to feel that no effort is too great in the service of your love. Dagny, your enemies are destroying you by means of your own power. Your generosity and your endurance are their only tools. Your unrequited rectitude is the only hold they have upon you. They know it. You don't. The day when you'll discover it is the only thing they dread. You must learn to understand them. You won't be free of them until you do. But when you do, you'll reach such a stage of rightful anger that you'll blast every rail of Taggart Transcontinental rather than let it serve them. But to leave it to them, she moaned, to abandon it, to abandon Taggart Transcontinental, when it's almost like a living person. It was. It isn't any longer. Leave it to them. It won't do them any good. Let it go. We don't need it. We can rebuild it. They can't. We'll survive without it. They won't. But we, brought down to renouncing and giving up. Dagny, we who've been called materialists by the killers of the human spirit, we're the only ones who know how little value or meaning there is in material objects as such, because we're the ones who create their value and meaning. We can afford to give them up for a short while in order to redeem something much more precious. We are the soul of which railroads, copper mines, steel mills, and oil wells are the body. And they are living entities that beat day and night, like our hearts, in the sacred function of supporting human life, but only so long as they remain our body, only so long as they remain the expression, the reward, and the property of achievement. Without us, they are corpses, and their sole product is poison, not wealth or food, the poison of disintegration that turns men into hordes of scavengers. Dagny, learn to understand the nature of your own power, and you'll understand the paradox you now see around you. You do not have to depend on any material possessions. They depend on you. You create them. You own the one and only tool of production. Wherever you are, you will always be able to produce. But the looters, by their own stated theory, are in desperate, permanent, congenital need and at the blind mercy of matter. Why don't you take them at their word? They need railroads, factories, mines, motors, which they cannot make or run. Of what use will your railroad be to them without you? Who held it together? Who kept it alive? Who saved it time and time again? Was it your brother James? Who fed him? Who fed the looters? Who produced their weapons? Who gave them the means to enslave you? The impossible spectacle of shabby little incompetence holding control over the products of genius. Who made it possible? Who supported your enemies? Who forged your chains? Who destroyed your achievement? The motion that threw her upright was like a silent cry. He shot to his feet with the stored abruptness of a spring uncoiling, his voice driving on in merciless triumph. You're beginning to see, aren't you? Dagny, leave them the carcass of that railroad. Leave them all the rusted rails and rotted ties and gutted engines. But don't leave them your mind. Don't leave them your mind. The fate of the world rests on that decision. Ladies and gentlemen, said the panic-pregnant voice of a radio announcer, breaking off the chords of the symphony, we interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin. The greatest disaster in railroad history occurred in the early hours of the morning on the main line of Taggart Transcontinental at Winston, Colorado, demolishing the famous Taggart Tunnel. Her screams sounded like the screams that had rung out in the one last moment in the darkness of the tunnel. Its sound remained with him through the rest of the broadcast, as they both ran to the radio in the cabin and stood, in equal terror, her eyes staring at the radio, his eyes watching her face. The details of the story were obtained from Luke Beale, fireman of the Taggart luxury mainliner, the Comet, who was found unconscious at the western portal of the tunnel this morning, and who appears to be the sole survivor of the catastrophe. Through some astounding infraction of safety rules, in circumstances not yet fully established, the Comet, westbound for San Francisco, was sent into the tunnel with a coal-burning steam locomotive. The Taggart Tunnel, an 8-mile bore, cut through the summit of the Rocky Mountains and regarded as an engineering achievement not to be equaled in our time, was built by the grandson of Nathaniel Taggart in the great age of the clean, smokeless diesel-electric engine. The tunnel's ventilation system was not designed to provide for the heavy smoke and fumes of coal-burning locomotives, and it was known to every railroad employee in the district that to send a train into the tunnel with such a locomotive would mean death by suffocation for everyone aboard. The Comet, nonetheless, was so ordered to proceed. According to Fireman Beale, the effects of the fumes began to be felt when the train was about 3 miles inside the tunnel. Engineer Joseph Scott threw the throttle wide open in a desperate attempt to gain speed, but the old, worn engine was inadequate for the weight of the long train and the rising grade of the track. Struggling through the thickening fumes, engineer and fireman had barely managed to force the leaking steam boilers up to a speed of 40 miles per hour, when some passenger, prompted undoubtedly by the panic of choking, pulled the emergency brake cord. The sudden jolt of the stop apparently broke the engine's air hose, for the train could not be started again. There were screams coming from the cars. Passengers were breaking windows. Engineer Scott struggled frantically to make the engine start, but collapsed at the throttle, overcome by the fumes. Fireman Beale leaped from the engine and ran. He was within sight of the western portal when he heard the blast of the explosion, which is the last thing he remembers. The rest of the story was gathered from railroad employees at Winston Station. It appears that an Army freight special, westbound, carrying a heavy load of explosives, had been given no warning about the presence of the Comet on the track just ahead. Both trains had encountered delays and were running off their schedules. It appears that the freight special had been ordered to proceed regardless of signals, because the tunnel's signal system was out of order. It is said that in spite of speed regulations and in view of the frequent breakdowns of the ventilating system, it was the tacit custom of all engineers to go full speed while in the tunnel. It appears, as far as can be established at present, that the Comet was stalled just beyond the point where the tunnel makes a sharp curve. It is believed that everyone aboard was dead by that time. It is doubted that the engineer of the freight special, turning a curve at 80 miles an hour, would have been able to see in time the observation window of the Comet's last car, which was brightly lighted when it left Winston Station. What is known is that the freight special crashed into the rear of the Comet. The explosion of the special's cargo broke windows in a farmhouse 5 miles away and brought down such a weight of rock upon the tunnel that rescue parties have not yet been able to come within 3 miles of where either train had been. It is not expected that any survivors will be found, and it is not believed that the Taggart Tunnel can ever be rebuilt. She stood still. She looked as if she were seeing, not the room around her, but the scene in Colorado. Her sudden movement had the abruptness of a convulsion. With the single-tracked rationality of a somnambulist, she whirled to find her handbag as if it were the only object in existence. She seized it. She whirled to the door and ran.
"Dagny," he screamed. "Don't go back."
The scream had no more power to reach her than if he were calling to her across the miles between him and the mountains of Colorado. He ran after her. He caught her, seizing her by both elbows, and he cried,
"Don't go back. Dagny, in the name of anything sacred to you, don't go back."
She looked as if she did not know who he was. In a contest of physical strength, he could have broken the bones of her arms without effort. but with the force of a living creature fighting for life, she tore herself loose so violently that she threw him off balance for a moment. When he regained his footing, she was running down the hill, running as he had run at the sound of the alarm siren in Reardon's Mills, running to her car on the road below. His letter of resignation lay on the desk before him, and James Taggart sat staring at it, hunched by hatred. He felt as if his enemy were this piece of paper, not the words on it, but the sheet and the ink that had given the words a material finality. He had always regarded thoughts and words as inconclusive, but a material